What could cause that? Clearly aliens can cause that, as happened in Roswell, New Mexico, as happens in a television show I like called The Event. You have to face facts that aliens are all around us, and they have finally gotten to the NHL.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
I met a dolphin down there, and I swear to God that dolphin looked not at me, but into my soul, into my goddamn soul, Annie, and said, "I'm saving you, Megan." Not with his mouth, but he said it, I'm assuming telepathically.
All right, well, I've kind of been a bit of a devil's advocate on this show here with you, but I don't mean to be that way. But I know I'm just going to this like going, tell me about Chapter 5 and all the things I agree about. You know what I mean? So I agree with a lot of the stuff in the book. But there was one point that I thought was sort of paradoxical in the book that I don't know if you were being sarcastic or what. So I guess I'll sort of ask you about this. Now, you have a whole chapter on the series of coincidences that happened to you in Los Angeles when you were babysitting. Oh, God, poor Greg. House sitting for Greg Bishop.
Right.
Well, you were babysitting the cat, I guess. So you were cat sitting.
Yes, he has a cat. So I was out in L.A. 3 years ago, and while Greg and Sigrid were on their honeymoon in Europe, and while I was there, my friend Christina Kafari stayed with me for a few days, and then my brother came out and stayed a few days. And in that period of time, yeah, there were some synchronistic experiences.
Right, right. A whole series of them. And
yes.
You, I wouldn't say you put a lot of credence into them, but you highlight them, let's say, and sort of make people look at that.
Sure.
But then later in the book, when you're ghost hunting, there's a painting that's supposed to be cursed. And if you touch it, someone you know will die or something along those lines. I'm sure you can clarify this. And you touched it, and then someone on your crew's family member died the next day. And then you have a conversation with another member of the crew, and they say, do you think, I'm going to quote, I'll read the exchange here from the book, because I copied it into my notes. Do you think, he asked, and then his voice trailed off. No, I answered, absolutely not. Yeah, he said, pure coincidence. Right, I replied. So I'm having trouble reconciling how you can put a lot of stock into these coincidences that happened in L.A., but then later you agree that it's a coincidence that you touched the painting and it led to these series of events. There's always the possibility that you touching the painting, that it is a coincidence in a sense, but, I mean, I don't know. I have trouble reconciling that, so maybe you can explain to me your point of view there.
Sure. It's no what did you say? A paradox at all. Two things that I would say. First of all, the thing with the painting, the sort of, let's call it an incident, whatever you want to call it with the painting,
all right,
happened prior to the coincidence, the run of coincidences. So you could look at it and say, even though I think in the book, the coincidence chapter comes before the
haunting. Right, right. Yeah, I realized the timeline was different. Yeah.
Yeah, it's because it's grouped by themes. So my opinions could have changed in the interim, but that's not actually the answer. But that could have been the answer. The actual answer is when we were talking, and I guess maybe it didn't come through when I was trying to write that in the book, although I thought it did. But this is the first feedback I've had on that. Dave and I were, and it's Dave Sadler, the guy that I'm talking to. He's one of the British guys we were working with. So we were working with a group called the UPIA. I always get the Unknown Phenomena Investigation Association.
Right.
Sure, that's it. And there were three guys. We were doing this investigation at a hotel that we were staying at, the Lion and Swan in Congleton. And yeah, one of the legends was there was this cheesy 60s painting in the basement. If you went down and touched that, somebody you knew would die. So Dave and I was back in not skeptic mode, but once you see the painting, I mean, it was like a half-naked woman.
Right, it's hard to take seriously kind of thing, yeah.
Yeah, totally hard to take seriously. And Dave and I were having a lot of fun because he's a fun-loving guy, I'm a fun-loving guy. And so we were kind of really, Holly and a couple of the other UPIA guys were upstairs doing the more serious stuff. So we're on camera and we're just kind of goofing off. And, you know, I kind of pick it up and blah, blah, blah. And Dave and was like, oh, hello. And we gave it a name and then we put it down and we thought nothing more about it. Well, one of the other UPIA guys, it's a very Bruce Willis, UPIA mother.
Oh.
Was upstairs.
Shut your mouth. Yeah.
Yeah. Shut your mouth. And the next, they're supposed to show up the next day, and we were going to this cemetery at an old church in Shoklack, and I write about that. Some weird stuff went down there, too.
Hmm.
But the two guys, Dave had been there many times before. The other two guys, Steve Mara and Paul Reeves, had not. So they had been going on about how they were really looking to forward to finally getting there. So, okay, the next morning rolls around. I get up, I go down for breakfast, and there's Dave and Steve Mara, but I don't see Paul Reeves. And he was definitely, like, supposed to be coming. And I walk over to Dave and Steve, and I say, hey, you know, where's Paul? I thought he might be out in the parking lot or something. I said, well, he's not coming. And I said, this is a paraphrase conversation. I can't remember the exact words, but, you know, I would have said something along the lines of, okay, why? Because he was, like, you know, really psyched last night. And they said, well, his father passed away early this morning, which is to say pretty much at a close to the same time we were screwing around with the painting.
Right.
And Steve wandered off, and he didn't, because he wasn't part of the make fun of the painting thing. And Dave and I really, we were standing there, and it was what I recount in the book is a very uneasy conversation where we're sort of like, yeah, that sucks. Yeah, big suck. Was he, like, you know, ill or anything? No, you know, he was old, but so old people die, but, you know, there wasn't anything, couldn't really see it coming. Oh, okay. Do you think maybe we sort of, that couldn't have been us, right? Yeah, no, I'm sure that wasn't us. Yeah, it's just a coincidence. Yeah. But that's kind of the tone it was
in. Okay, yeah. I didn't know if you were being sarcastic or not, so. Sarcastic may not be the right word, but you know what it's not.
Yeah, it's one of those things that comes through in the book, too, at least I hope it does, this idea, my own kind of journey, and trying to not apologize for my interest in the paranormal, but that includes to myself, to not be embarrassed by it. So when certain things happen, and there's a couple of times in the book, certainly in the when I talk about the Shacklack Cemetery thing, when I saw what I call a void in the sky, or when I heard the horse's hooves, and if folks read it, they'll understand what I'm talking about. But these sort of paranormal, these kind of anomalous events where a number of us heard what sounded like horse's hooves, and that's part of the legend, the ghostly legend of that cemetery. There's nothing around there that could create that sound, but people had heard it. I heard it. Holly heard it. My co-host Holly Stevens heard it twice. But here's the thing. I didn't tell anybody that I had seen the void in the sky or heard their horse's hooves until other people had mentioned that they had, in the void in the sky, this kind of black shape that appeared in the sky. My co-producer, Dale Stevens, came over to me and he said, hey, Paul, I got to tell you, you know, guess what happened? I was just sitting at the back of the church. And I said, I don't know, Dave or Dale, what happened? He said, I saw this black thing in the sky over there at a different time than I had seen it now. And he describes it, and I went, well, here's the thing. Me too. Over there, in a different direction, at a different time. Really? Yeah. Freaky. Why didn't you say something, Paul? And then, of course, now that I have confirmation that somebody else, I don't feel embarrassed by it. So then we did a segment on it, and I talked about everything else. But Holly had gone through this thing. She had been in the part of the church. She had heard the horses. I knew she had talked about it. She had been very upset. A little upset, actually.
Shaken.
Sort of exactly. Perfect word. Shaken. I knew that. And so I kind of walk over at one point, and I try and sort of comfort her or whatever, reassure her. And then I just wander away. And she hears it again. And I come over, and she's like, well, I'm really, like, freaked out. You can see in the episode, which is online. It's available online. I'll post a link in your form or whatever. And you can kind of – you don't see everything because a lot of this was – it worked out. It was just off camera. But you do see some of it. And I say, well, here's the thing. I heard it too. And she goes, what? You know, I thought she was going to throttle me. She said, why didn't you say anything? I said, well, you know, I kind of like to pocket these things because I get a little embarrassed about admitting that maybe I experienced something paranormal. Because I'm still going through that process. It's that I don't have that problem anymore, obviously. I've written a book about it, or I'm talking about it to you on the radio with it. But back then, even while I was shooting a television series where I am a ghost investigator, my whole purpose on being on television, like on screen, is to investigate these things. And things were happening to me. I had trouble kind of wrapping my mind around it and just admitting it because that laughter curtain.
Right.
It's self-imposed. I was afraid of what people would think of me. But then, you know, that I think back to that conversation I had with my friend about Obama and God and all that sort of stuff. It's like, why should we be embarrassed by this? If something happened, it happened. I'm not going to say what it is, but something happened. I heard horses' hooves in a cemetery on cobblestones, and I live in a city where there are cobblestone streets. I've actually heard horses' hooves, you know, because we have Halifax and Old City. And so anyway, to make this short for your audience, but so they can understand, that it's a 13th century church, and people who've been in the church have heard the sound of clip-clop, 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 which would be the sound that hearses would have made when they were drawn by horses. Well, there's no, the only road around there is a mud track. There's absolutely nothing that could have made those sounds. And we looked, believe me, we looked,
yeah.
We walked into the pastures next, we looked all around. But Holly heard it a couple of times, I heard it, and then, as we were talking about it, this is the part that unfortunately wasn't on camera, we both heard it at the same time, and she looked at me, and I talk about this in the book, she goes, did you? And I went, here? Kind of one of those moments where you both, and we had a number of those doing the show, and it's like, okay, that's just weird. How do you explain that? And if it's just one, you can maybe you can rationalize it. If it's just two, maybe you can rationalize it. But when it's happening over and over again, Walter Bosley sort of talks about it, how you can kind of, when we were, because he's involved in the synchronicity thing, because some one of the sort of at the penultimate end of the synchronicity run in Los Angeles happened while we were on Radio Misterioso talking about this run of synchronicities that I'd been on, and then they start happening on the radio show to Walter and I, kind of with Greg sort of playing referee and observing it all. But I described in the book, you can also go back to the episode on Radio Misterioso and listen to it happening in real time. But I think, what does Walter call it? The nexus of reality or something like that. Or he has a cute phrase for it that's I think I put in the book. But that's sort of what, when you get involved in these things, you can go 40 years or 40, in my case, I guess it was 42 years, and never really have anything happen, or at least not think about it, but then have, because you put yourself in a situation, then it starts to happen.
Yeah.
Or, as Greg or Walter might have said, it's always been happening, but now you're in a place where you can actually see it.
Right.
To use the artistic metaphor, assume it's like a performance, you can actually see Cirque du Soleil unless you buy a ticket, right? I mean, you could sneak in, I guess, but you know what I mean. Unless you actually go into the theater or Getty Center or whatever, you're not going to see the Jackson Pollock. You're not going to see Cirque du Soleil. I think the paranormal is the same way. The ticket you have to buy is a willingness to, an openness to have something interact with you. And if you don't have that, then I don't think it's going to happen. So you have to actually be willing to have it happen, or you at least have to be aware of the possibility that maybe it is going to happen. So maybe my book, hopefully for some folks, will be a ticket. They'll read it and they'll go, oh, okay, some strange things happened to Kimball, or at least he says they did. We'll assume he's telling the truth. Maybe strange things happened to people, and he's not a guy we ever would have thought that, you know, would have talked about these strange things, but they happened to him. Weird. Well, if they can happen to him, maybe they can happen to me. That's the ticket. Maybe I've opened the door for you, so that you have your own experiences, because now you're aware that they could literally happen to anyone, including a guy who used to be not an arch skeptic, but certainly would have sat on the more materialistic side of the paranormal fence. And you can listen to past appearances on Banal of America and other shows where I would have, you know, gone after a whole range of people for being crazy. I don't do that anymore, because the first person I would have to go after would be me.
Oh.
And I'd have to say, Paul, you're crazy, because you've had these experiences. I can't explain what they were, but I can no longer deny that I've had them.
All right. So, in summation, the conversation about the cursed painting incident was sort of a tongue-in-cheek, in a sense.
It was a very uncomfortable conversation.
Okay.
I wouldn't say tongue-in-cheek, because we... You know,
I know, I'm trying to search for the right word. I'm not saying...
Yeah.
I said sarcastic before, but I think I know... There's probably one of those weird German words for it that we don't have in English, you know?
Exactly, like Achtung.
Yeah, exactly.
Very Achtung situation.
Right.
I'm pretty sure your audience knows from just us butchering it what we're kind of talking about.
Yeah,
here.
Exactly.
This is the problem with verbal communication. Greg and I have talked about it on his show and on my own podcast, and I talk about it in the book, that words can sometimes be inadequate because you might not know them or you can't think of them. But I think both you and I and anyone listening to this now kind of understand what we're talking about. It was a very uncomfortable situation.
Mm-hmm.
Dave and I were very, it's like, you know, we didn't want, because he's like me. He's sarcastic And he was the guy who'd been to Shacklack, that church where all the weird stuff had happened. He had had, I described this in the book, he had had a time slip experience happen that when he described it to us, he and a friend were at the church. The friend had brought a little kid along with them. Dave wanted, and his friend wanted to talk about something that adults, you know, an adult conversation. So they said, oh, look, little kid, go, you know, run away, play in the cemetery for a bit and, you know, come back later. So they saw the kid go around the corner of the church, and it's a, you know, rather largest church. And so you could say, well, maybe it would take a kid of that age, you know, 4 or 5, whatever the kid was, 20 or 30 seconds to get around the church, even at top speed, if they were really booting it and the kid had been walking. Boom, kid goes, they notice the kid goes around the corner of the church. Suddenly the kid's at the other corner of the church, the exact opposite. I say to Dave, I say, okay, Dave, you and I, outside the camera range, I say, we're serious guys, right? You know, we kind of the paranormal, we're a little, we have this antithetical relationship to, or we don't like to admit, especially Dave, that we've experienced something paranormal. But what the hell do you call that besides paranormal? And Dave's like, right, well, you know, I don't know. And then he sort of wandered off. And I interviewed him later for a little podcast, and I said, Dave, I just need you to admit that what happened to you there, if you're telling the truth, if that actually happened, he said, oh, it did. That's paranormal, man. I'm not asking you to tell me what it was. I'm just asking you to admit that was freaky, weird, and paranormal, and you can't explain. He said, right, yeah, you know, yeah. So I said, great, so you believe that paranormal things happen. He said, well, yeah. So, you know, you still have that kind of, and he does, but you still have that sort of, it's hard to kind of admit it, especially when you've spent most of your life immersed in a world that tells you, here's the truth that they give us, this is impossible, this can't happen. And then you realize there's another side of the truth when it happens to you. It is possible. It does happen. I can't explain it, but it interests me and it makes me think.
You could almost call it the other side of truth.
You could. And if you were really clever, you'd probably write a book with that title. Mm. Oh, wait. Hold on. Copyrighted too, folks.
Oh.
You can't copyright a title.
So oh, good.
In fact, there is another book called The Other Side of Truth.
Oh, really?
I didn't realize this, but when it went up on Amazon, I, you know, just did a search to see what my book page looked like, and boom. And you realize, is it Beverly Naidu or something? I think it's a kid's book.
Oh, that's good.
For children. And it's quite popular, so it shows up well before mine does.
Yeah, but, you know, that can result in some accidental sales.
Mostly, yeah, probably. Yeah, oh, I never thought of that.
People will look at your book, and they'll be like, why did my sister-in-law say that I should get this book for my kid? I don't know what's weird. One thing that I noticed in the book, beyond the shout-out to Rainbow Valley in Prince Edward Island, which I actually went to also as a child. So, I don't think we ran into each other, though, because I think you probably went in the 70s, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I went in the 80s.
For folks who don't know, it's Prince Edward Island, a small province in eastern Canada. It's an old Rainbow Valley. They used to have a series of old kind of theme parks. Not to call them mini Disneys is not even close to accurate.
Right, right.
So, but Rainbow Valley was the coolest of the bunch because they had a flying saucer gift shop. The gift shop was shaped like a flying saucer, and that as a young kid, that was probably the coolest thing I had ever seen.
I did have a question about that actually. What now, Rainbow Valley? You said it went out of business at some point in the 90s or the last decade. What became of all the stuff in Rainbow Valley?
I don't know, actually. I was there, when was the last time I was up in the North Shore? Actually, it was this summer, but I didn't drive up as far as Rainbow Valley. It's now it's a different kind of theme park. They took the property, they turned it into a theme park called Sandspit that has, you know, bumper boats and go-karts, all the things that kids today like, as opposed to the more, because Rainbow Valley in the old days, it was really, here's a bunch of land kids with a flying saucer theme park, and every now and then we'll put a small little sculpture of a gnome or an elf, and use your imagination.
Yeah.
that was it. And that, you know, that was, Fairyland was the same way and everything, and that was fine for us, but now they have to have bumper boats and stuff. I don't know what they did with the flying saucer, though. And that's actually a pretty good question, because it was really cool. I mean, and I think, In the book, I don't have a photo of it, but I have in the footnotes, you know, it's like, here's a link to Rainbow Valley, this site that somebody made about
it. Right, yeah, I
checked it out. And so you can see if you put that link into your Google or whatever, you'll be able to see a picture. And, you know, if you were there, Tim, you must remember the flying saucer too.
Vaguely. I barely remember it because it was in the 80s when I was like a little kid. So, but I do remember being excited about going there and then returning a few years later and, you know, being promised that we could go. So it resonates somehow. So it must have been something enjoyable about it, but I don't remember what.
It's weird. I had never, until I was writing the book, I didn't really think back to too much to my days venturing in PEI as a young kid. But when people would ask me, and they have for years, you know, why are you interested? Where'd your interest in UFOs come from? Is it because your uncle is Stan Friedman? Well, sure, that's part of it. But then I thought, you know, even before Stan was my uncle, because he married into the family in the mid-70s, I saw the flying saucer theme, you know, gift shop in Rainbow Valley. So that if you're a five-year-old kid and you see this giant flying saucer that you can walk into and stuff, that must have some sort of impact on your on what happens to you when you grow up. So
interesting, yeah. Now the other thing, I that was sort of a light point, and I threw a couple of light points in here, and we've gone quite a ways here on deep discussion. So the other thing I was going to ask you about, and I remember you telling me this in 2007 when I hung out with you in Halifax, but you make a point in the book that this is still the case, and that's that you own no cell phone, which I find interesting. I was on the no cell phone team for a long time, but eventually, about a year ago, I had to switch sides and join up with cell phone people. And
I have not. I have not.
It's a curse. It's a double edged sword, really. It's the convenience of it is nice, but you really do. It's everything I wanted to avoid when I didn't have a cell phone.
Well, it's the let's not go too long, but for me it's kind of it's my one walled-in moment that I still hang on to, because if you have a cell phone, especially in my business, people will expect you to be available 24/7. And maybe I should be, I don't know. But I don't want to be available 24/7. There's these wonderful things called answering machines or whatever you want to, or callback or whatever.
And voicemail.
So if I'm not voicemail. Here's a little story that has really nothing to do with the paranormal, but it has a little to do with me, and as the book's a bit about me, I'll tell it anyway, because it's a cute story. About 10 years ago, my old partner and I, we had a meeting set up with an American producer from Los Angeles who wanted to bring a major, by which I mean, you know, $7 million production, up to Nova Scotia. And they eventually did. We were, because my former partner and I had both run the tax credit at different times in the Nova Scotia government, we were going to be tapped as the service producers, which is to say the locals who would basically run the paperwork for them while they shot the production. It was a lucrative gig. I mean, each of us might have made $50,000. I think it was about $50,000. So we sat down, had a meeting with the guy, blah, blah, blah. Everything went great. As we're getting ready to leave, or he was getting ready to leave, the meeting's breaking up. He looks over and he says, "Hey, you got your cards? We're exchanging cards." He looks at my card and he says, "Oh, I don't see your cell phone number on here." I had my home, the office phone with my cell phone number. And I said, "Well, I don't have a cell phone." Now, he then asked two questions in succession. I've been told later that I could have survived the first answer that I gave, but not the second. So the first question he asks is, "Well, if you don't have a cell phone, how am I going to get in touch with you if you're not in the office?" I said, "Well, you leave a message. We have a voicemail. I would call you back, you know, as soon as I get back. My partner's often in the office. I mean, not a problem. But when I'm out of the office, I'm out of the office." And so that, I probably could live with it. But then he says, "Well, but that's not how we do things in Los Angeles." And I said, "Well, in case you hadn't noticed, you're not in Los Angeles." Boom! He was literally out the door in about 10 seconds. Like, he didn't even say goodbye. He stood up, boom, out the door, and my partner was like, "What the fuck?" And, you know, the guy who'd set the meeting, I was like, "Oh, he's running out in the hall. I'll get him back, I'll get him back." He never came back.
Wow, was that stern of a reaction, huh?
Yeah, so as I still, in fact, I'll be having coffee with my ex-partner. We're still friends. We didn't stop being partners because of that. But every now and then he reminds me about that, and I always say, yeah, it's my $50,000 story. that's me literally just being the snarky guy I am, saying, yeah, screw you, and $50,000 wandered out of my...
Right.
Yeah.
Well,
I still don't have a cell phone. I hope to never have them, even though I recognize their utility.
Right. It's an interesting area sort of to talk about. It's something I've discussed with other guests on the show, and it's like I've railed against, because I try to at least be, I wouldn't say responsible, but, well, I'm certainly responsible. I don't even know how to text. I think I've texted a few times in my life, but I'm not one of those people that like texts and drives and all that shit. And I actually don't even use the cell phone. I'd say 10% of the cell phone use is for actual phone calls. So really, for me, it's like a little mini computer to be online. And that's the double-edged sword of it, where it's like, I yearn for being away from being online all the time, but at some point I realize that once you get to be able to be online all the time, it's nice, but you realize it's not necessarily a good thing. And I've seen people that are way off the page with this. Most people, I don't want to call them in the mainstream, but, you know, the lemmings, if you will, which is, you know, or I forget what the sheeple, as the people in the paranormal community like to rail against people who aren't interested in all this. You know, they're on their phone. They're like in the machine now, which is a scary development for the race, for the human race. That's something, you know, that I said is worth sort of contemplating.
Sure, and there's a couple of things. One, there's nothing wrong with technology, and there's nothing wrong with using technology. So I'm not anti-cell phone. I'm just anti-cell phone for me, because I want, when I am not around the phone. I mean, like, I'm on the computer all the time. People say, oh, my God, Paul, you live on Facebook. Well, no. When I'm working, I do most of my work on the computer. The internet is always on because, you know, I might be getting an email. I mean, I do take my business seriously. I don't want to lose another $50,000 contract. So if I'm in front of the computer working, I leave the internet on. I often will listen to iTunes or YouTube or a podcast or whatever. And so, yeah, it might look like I'm always on Facebook because I'll take a minute, post a catchy little picture of a cat or something,
right,
and then go back to work. If you didn't know better, you'd think I'm always on Facebook. But here's the thing. When I leave my office here at home and I go for a walk or I want to go to the mall or a movie or whatever, I leave the computer, I leave that interconnectivity behind because now I'm not connected. The problem comes not with being connected, but with being constantly connected and feeling like you can't exist if you're not connected.
Mm.
And that is a generational thing that I've noticed, not my generation, not even yours, you're younger, but a couple of generations behind us.
Yeah.
And now it's seeping up into adults where you can see, and I actually write about this in the book, in the, it's funny how we wind up there. I put a couple poems in the book in the chapter about the human condition. And I was standing in a food court once a couple years ago in a shopping mall just waiting for a friend of mine to finish shopping. And I just started observing people, which is, you know, what artists do, walking by. And virtually every single one of them was staring down at a cell. Now, this was around Christmas, was staring down at a cell phone or whatever you call them, you know. I still call them Palm Pilots. We're still too
young
to know about
them.
So here's a little poetry corner for Banal of America, because you brought this up, but it actually, this is apropos. So we wound up here by mistake, unless you planned this, in which case, good for you. Time stops by the third floor railing next to the food court. No real food actually served. As I endure the gray glop mush of mediocrity which passes for the human race these days, the screens of their Blackberries, the only illumination they'll ever know. If they all dropped dead, no one would miss them, least of all themselves. An inconspicuously conspicuous mass of conspicuously inconspicuous consumerites. Legions of the lackluster for the new imperium. Mac always liked that poem. But that idea comes back to that idea of the human condition, that we're disconnected from the things that are important to us. So, in a way, you know, we're all influenced by different things. I'm influenced a lot by science fiction because I like science fiction. I like all fiction. But I think science fiction says a lot to us, not necessarily about the future or these strange worlds we imagine, but it's designed to tell us about ourselves. Again, the artist using art as a way of a teaching point, if you will, while entertaining. So one of my favorite pieces of science fiction is Battlestar Galactica. Not the old series, although I have a soft spot for it, but the reimagined series that was out over the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end, it's really, for television especially, it's really deep stuff, the kind of stuff that makes us think about who we are, relationship with technology. There's also a very strong spiritual element in it, even a religious element, but artificial life, all of that stuff. And at the end of it, though, here's what happens. And if you've, spoiler alert, if you haven't watched Battlestar Galactica, I'm about to tell you what happens at the end of the show.
The whole show?
Yeah.
Oh, God. All right.
No, this won't take very long.
But no, I know. I've just never seen it. You're going to ruin it for me.
Oh,
but all right.
Oh, well, if you haven't seen it by now, you probably, I have the DVDs. I tried to get my brother to watch them. I tried to get my, my former fiance, who's still my best friend. I still live with her to watch them. Neither one of them have watched
it. Yeah, I've never gone out of my way. I could probably watch it on Netflix if I wanted, but I don't. So,
exactly.
All right, go ahead and spoil it.
So they've been fleeing from the Cylons for 4 years since the fall of humanity, since the Cylons destroyed almost all humans. And there's only about, at the end, 25,000 of them. So they've been fighting, and this technological society, and the Cylons are their creation. And finally they ally with some of these Cylons, who can resurrect themselves, so there's an element of reincarnation.
Yeah.
And they finally arrive at Earth. It's not the original Earth, but it's a different Earth. Long story, doesn't matter. And what it is our planet, this Earth. And it's set about 150,000 years in the past. So they get here 150,000 years ago. And they get down to the planet, and the survivors, there's about, you know, maybe 25,000 of them. It's a highly advanced technological society. And they say, well, okay, here's what we're going to do. We'll map out a new city here. We can build here. We can rebuild, blah, blah, blah. And Lee Adama, who's the son of Admiral Adama, who's the leader of the fleet, he's become sort of the president of these colonies, the survivors of humanity, says, no. We're going to leave all of that behind. We are going to fly all of our ships into the sun, which is what they do. They set them on autopilot and fly. The entire fleet goes into the sun. They divorce themselves from technology, and they say, we're just going to start again. None of that matters. You know, we've been on the run from death for 4 years. Our entire civilization was destroyed through our own hubris in creating artificial life, all this stuff. Let's just get focus on living and being. He doesn't quite phrase it like that, but that's the point. And the older I get, I don't know when it happened, Tim, but the older I get, the more I become like Lee Adama. That all the things that, you know, I'm 45 now, almost 46. The things that I've done a lot of stuff. I've been to a lot of interesting places. I hope to go to a lot of interesting places and do interesting things in the future. But more and more, I joke with my dad. He thinks I'm joking, but I'm not. More and more, I envision a future where I pull a Lee Adama, a Battlestar Galactica, where I just say, you know what? There's a cabin in the woods with my name on it.
Uh-oh.
I'm heading out, and I'm not coming back. I mean, I'll go into town to get supplies and stuff like that, but I just want to front the world in a more real way than all this technology. So I'm actually trying to leave. You know, I have a business to run. I have to deal with
it. You sound like the Unabomber now. I was just getting scared.
Well, no, that's bad. That's
yeah, well, you see, you're fleeing to a cabin in the woods to get away from technology, but you'll go into town every once again for supplies. It's
exactly.
It's really...
Did I say fleeing? I shouldn't have said fleeing. I'm not fleeing. I would want to move into looking at things in a different way. At some point, you've done it. So it doesn't interest me. I watch less television than I used to. I could go down a whole range of things.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's great. I have nothing against that. It's the cell phone thing. I have nothing against cell phones. It's just not for me. And the older I get, the more I've done and put in my rear view mirror, the more I look forward to a time when I can just sit and be, as opposed to trying to, you know, move around and be what somebody else wants me to be or be all these other things. And so I carve these moments out for myself. And that helped with writing the book. I mean, some of that sweeps into the book, this kind of looking at people who just walk around staring into their Blackberries and good for their, or whatever you call them, good for them. It's just, that's not what I want to do, and I don't think that's healthy. And that's not what technology should be about, because I know what most of them are looking at. I've seen the texts that people send. They're not texting about important things like philosophy or any of that.
No. It's base level shit. And you know, the way people write and everything, it's not good. It's not a good thing.
Do you want Fruit Loops or Captain Crunch? I've actually heard that conversation. Now, my mom in the old days, when she would go shopping, she'd write out a list beforehand, and she'd go. And you know what? If she got there and she wasn't quite sure what maybe cereal dad or the kids would want, she'd wing it. She'd make a call. Now, I actually heard somebody a couple years ago call somebody up in the cereal section and, you know, hey, listen, I'm here. Do you want, like, Frosted Flakes, Fruit Loops, Cap'n Crunch, or what? You know, what was it you wanted? Like, sure, because it's 30 cents less for that. I'm thinking, what the hell are you doing? This is not what cell phones were invented for. And then I thought, well, okay, maybe it is.
Yeah, maybe it is. That's the weird part.
Yeah, but that's all part of the human condition is we can't divorce ourselves from technology. It's not possible, I don't think. But we need to control it. We need to never lose sight of being human. It's one of the areas where I disagreed with Mac. He looked forward to a post-human future where we would meld with machinery and all that sort of stuff. I'm not sure that I'm against it, but at the end of the day, I don't want to be a post-human. I just want to be a better human. And if technology can make us a better human, then I think that's a good thing. But if technology turns us into something else that we're not, if we become slaves to it, then I think that's a bad thing. And I look at technology now and I see us becoming slaves to it. And I don't even think we realize it. And we might not realize it until it's too late. Like the humans in Battlestar Galactica.
Exactly, yeah. I don't know. Slaves, I don't know. Addicts, maybe.
Well, yes, but addicts are slaves. I mean,
I guess you're right, yeah, I suppose. We're quibbling. That's semantics, yeah.
But ultimately, you've made, unlike somebody who comes to your village and takes you away to a different continent and makes you a slave, you've actually started drinking or using drugs or technology, and then you've taken yourself further and further and further. You've made yourself a slave to whatever it is. But it's the principle is the same, you know, rise up against whoever your evil master is, in this case, you, and liberate yourself as much as you can.
Have some self-awareness.
Bingo.
Exactly.
I mean, it weird. It does kind of sound, quote-unquote, new agey, but both you and I are talking. I actually sort of say that in the book. I say, yeah, I know all of this sounds new agey, but is that a bad thing? Because the alternative would be old agey, right? And if we think about it, what is the old age? What has it gotten us? Where has it taken us? Not to a good place, and not to a place that I think fulfills the ultimate potential that I see. This is the positive note that I see in humans, in humanity. Like you, I do believe that there is intrinsic goodness in us. I just think we've abdicated our responsibility for finding that goodness, and it hasn't helped that really bad humans, and there are a few, have made it harder for us. But we've moved ourselves away as a society from that. But I do see that we can move this new age. I'm all for it because the old age hasn't worked out all that well.
Indeed. But old age itself, I feel like you're ready for it. You're going to be great at it.
I'm already halfway there.
Exactly.
I might already be there. I'm a curmudgeon. I've become a friendly curmudgeon.
You must own a rocking chair. You seem like the type.
I'd like to, but no, I have a papasan.
What's a papasan?
That's a big cushy wicker chair with a big fluffy thing that
fulfills
the same function. You just kind of sit in it and go, oh, this is nice.
Without the rocking, though. You don't have the rocking.
No, I don't have the rocking, although I can rock in my mind and roll, too.
Oh!
Yes. I mean, all of this is a personal journey, too, and I talk about this in the book. A fair bit of it is personal. There's a chapter on I can't even remember. I think it is The Eternal Now. I'm not sure of that chapter. But when I talk about a friend of mine who died when I was young, friend in high school, every year I go over to his grave and I sit down, I listen to music. It's funny because it is the passage of time. In the book I mentioned, when I started doing this in the 80s, I was listening to my Walkman. So I'd have a cassette tape. I always take Simon and Garfunkel's album with Hazy Shade of Winter on it. And I would sit down. Now I go over with my MP3 player, and I have 3,000 songs on it, but I'm still picking the same song. I sit down, listen. I read from some Camus, Albert Camus, to him. I do that every year. But he died in a car accident 3 years after I had a car accident that probably should have killed me. I got very lucky. And so I kind of say, look, I like to think, and he was a really sweet guy, far sweeter than I was. I mean, I was a hellion, arrogant, hubristic.
Yeah, you're a little prick.
Yeah, and some people listening to this would go, wait a second. And I would be one of them. There's still elements of that, a lot of elements of that within me. It's the sort of love-hate thing that you put on your knuckles, the Johnny Cash thing, where you struggle with those demons within you, the good and the bad. But that's part of the human journey. But I say, look, if there are alternate universes, I like to think that Gil Ladder, my friend that died, he's sitting in some alternate universe. He survived and I didn't. And he's sitting on next to my grave right now, listening to the same music and reading the same, or maybe something different. But, it worked out better for him, and maybe that would be a more just resolution. But that's that process of examining who we are, where our journey has taken us as individuals, and where it's going to take us in the future as individuals. And if all of us as individuals undertake that process, then I think as a collective, we'll be okay. The problem is that most of us as individuals don't think that way. And I wish more did.
Don't we all? Well, I'm sure the people listening do.
Well,
most of them. Some of them.
And if you do think that way, buy my book. No.
There you go. Now you're getting the hang of being an author.
Yes. Well, I've learned from the best, Nick and others. So
I got one.
These are,
What's that?
I was just going to say, these are themes, too, that the other book that I published so far is I got the rights from Max Parent, sort of the whoever saved Kafka's writing, I don't know, the guy who did, but I've become that guy to Max Kafka, in a sense. So I'm going to be publishing, the first volume is out, 2003-2004, but I'm going to publish his blog, The Posthuman Blues. Because you just don't know how long something's going to be up on the internet, but B, because there's a lot of, you know, it's a daily journal, there's a lot of stuff that slipped in there that people, it's like, skip over this, that video doesn't even, it's not even up anymore that Mac posted of some YouTube video or something. But if you pull out, if you edit out all of that stuff and then just focus in on what Mac was writing in one place, that's what I've done with these series of books, the first one of which is out. And you realize that these are the kinds of things that he was talking about too. You know, the human condition. He was very, in a way, misanthropic. If you read the book, if you think you knew Mac, read the book, you'll realize, even those of us who really knew him, it's like, oh, this is the first time we kind of all got it in one place. And then you go, right, yeah, he was really cranky, you know, about all this. But it really is a very, I think, important historical document at the time, because you have a bright guy talking about the way things were in the 21st decade of the 21st century. It's a shame he's not, shame doesn't even begin to cover it. But he had so many things to say to sort of describe the human experience for people of our age, that general age group at that period of time. And he was talking about these same kinds of things that you and I are talking about here. Where have we been? Where are we now? And where do we need to be going? And he had different answers in many cases than I did, or at least different perspectives. And so to be able to do something like that, I mean, that's, you know, why you start a publishing company.
Indeed. All right. Yeah. Yeah.
That's probably apropos of nothing, but I did want to mention The Posthuman Blues.
I was going to mention it. What are you?
Oh,
Jesus. What kind of radio host do you think I am?
I don't know.
Jeez.
A good one.
Thank you. Then you should have known I would mention it.
Well, okay. Fine. just edit the show and stick that answer at the end after you ask the question.
Then we'll lose this fantastic exchange.
Okay.
Now, I have one more big point here, which is partially why I wanted to go, you know, longer than normal here, because I know that this is going to open a whole doorway, which is in the quote, into a conversation that could go for a while. So I figured I needed to get more time from you. But now I'm going to read a – you say in the book that you're convinced of what happens after you die, essentially. You become convinced of this. And I'll read the quote so it doesn't sound so cut and dry. So here's what you say. Many people have described seeing the white light during what have become known as near-death experiences, where a sort of doorway opens that we can go through. This could well be the moment of transition to the next stage of our development, which I'm convinced would be a collective consciousness where we leave our individuality behind and become one with each other in a being that would be by its very nature empathic and therefore moral. I'm always struck, I guess you could say, by certainty in authors or in researchers, and you know, I'm always weary of it, and it just stood out to me because I don't think you really went sort of full bore on anything in the book beyond that, where you say you're convinced of something. So what makes you convinced of this?
See, now I've actually got the book in front of me, and I do sort of, obviously I do remember that. I'm just trying to find it so that I can place it in the context. I know the chapter it's in too. I just can't find it. Oh, well. Because it would be easier to talk about it if I could actually find it. Tim, you're supposed to send me these questions first. Well, I don't know how certain I am. I mean, you know, I put that forward as, if you read back further into that chapter, which I believe is the chapter on reincarnation, I'm pretty sure it is. You know, it's like, well, okay, what happens to us after we die?
It's on page 164, if that helps.
Oh, thanks, man. That'll make it easier. 128, 208, 160. Oop, there we go. Sorry, folks.
It's all right.
A moment here.
And I'm not even saying, oh, you're wrong, I disagree, or anything like that. I'm asking, what led you to become convinced?
Well, okay, it's on page 164 of the version I sent you, but it's not on page 164 of the actual book. I must have renumbered the pages after I finished the draft I sent you. Anyway, I know what you're talking about. Well, if you look at it, sort of, let's assume that we die and there is something beyond death. So this is kind of how I come to the conclusion that I came to, which is the same kind of conclusion that I come to when I say that whatever they are, they're not here to do us harm. They're not here to ignore us. People might disagree with that, but here's the process I come to.
Right.
So there's something after death. Well, okay. Does Tim Banal continue on as Tim Banal after death? So basically it's, you know, it's just like you woke up in a different bed, but you're still you, and maybe you're wearing a different coat.
Mm.
But you're still this, and this is kind of, I think, how most people, certainly in the Western world, think about it. They say, oh, we'll meet grandma and grandpa and my brothers and sisters in heaven and all that sort of thing, and we'll basically just be ourselves, right? If you read DC Comics, when you see that all their characters eventually die and come back to life, it'd be like, oh, look, here's Green Arrow. He's in heaven dressed as Green Arrow. And there's the Flash, who's also, I remember this issue. There's Green Lantern and the Flash. They're also in heaven, and they're still dressed like the Flash and Green. What the hell? That's, I don't even think they're trying to make a point here. They're taking this literally.
Yeah.
And that just, it's hard to explain. That just doesn't make any sense to me. What does make sense to me? Oh, I remember. I'm trying to remember all this. I sort of remember how I came to this. When I was at the lecture by Michio Kaku, which I talked about in the first chapter, and he was describing communication in email and how basically email was created by the military to sort of compartmentalize various aspects of communication, then can all be reassembled later. I've done terrible disservice to that, but I'm much more coherent in the book because I literally quote from him. So there you go.
Yeah.
Well, then I said, well, wait a second now. What if we are the information in sort of a meta sense here? So his example of the email, which he was using in a different context, I said, well, wait, let's look at ourselves as the information. We're the information. We're all constituent parts of one whole message. So Tim Banal is a teeny little piece of that part. Paul Kimmel's a little piece of that part. Greg Bishop, Chris McBride, and who's somebody I mentioned in the book, both you and I know, were all, for good or ill, pieces of that email, if you will, that cosmic email.
Right.
Well, right. So when we die, that's the email being I'm talking about death as an email. That's the D-mail, the death mail. Yeah, that's the D-mail.
There you go, yeah.
Being reassembled. And so I talk about reincarnation, about how I think we, you know, we can come back and forth, live different lives, live different experiences. Maybe we're bats. Maybe we come back as paramecium to get the full range of possible experience. And then when that's all done, it's like the old Star Trek episode in Voyager where they go to the Q continuum and Q says, look, we're immortal. I've been the dog. I've been the scarecrow. I've been the door. I've been everything. When that's all over, well, okay, what's left? And that's when you reintegrate to the whole, and you become part, you realize, hey, I'm going back to the message. And then it gets really, I don't even talk about that. What happens after that? I don't know. But if that happens, if there is a collective consciousness, doesn't forget how I got there, but let's just, people do talk about a collective consciousness. If it does exist, I am absolutely convinced it would be empathic and what I call moral, which is to say good, because I can't see any other possibility. Because if I can feel somebody else's pain, unless you're really, really, really evil, and I just don't think there are that many really, really, really evil. I'm not even sure there are any evil people in the world. If you take this idea that we have to live all experiences, well, at some point you're going to be Hitler and so am I, or John Paul Gacy or whatever. If you view that as that idea that we have to do everything, well, you'll be Gandhi and Hitler at some point in the continuum. But if you can actually feel the pain that's being caused, you wouldn't cause it. Because, you know, I wouldn't cause pain to myself, or at least I wouldn't, especially if I was smarter than I probably am. So it's this, you know, if we're all in it together, then you would be empathic. You would have this understanding, a much greater understanding than just an individual would, because you could see the entire message, first of all. You'd realize there is a message, and individuality isn't it, that the individuals are just part of it. And some of my American friends who are the more libertarian types would be tearing their hair out right now. But,
well, that's the part that I, now I say I don't disagree with you, but I have trouble with that proposition because of what you just said. I mean, I have, I don't know, an intellectual disconnect with the idea of leaving the individuality behind. It's a bit subversive to me.
Yeah, well, it is very, in a sense, subversive. People, oh, it's communism or whatever. It's not even communism. It is very subversive to the Western way of thinking. It's not subversive to the Eastern mentality. And I use East. I think everybody listening knows what I mean when I say Eastern mentality. You know, Buddhism and those traditions coming from that part of the world. So it is not foreign to them. It is foreign to us because we view the individual as the sort of, that's it. It's the beginning, it's the end. But that, even if you look, and I've spent a lot of time, a lot of my family are Christians. My grandfather was a Reformed Baptist minister. I'm well aware of these things, even if I'm an agnostic when it comes to any of this stuff, in the particular traditions. If you look at the original teachings of Jesus, as far as we can tell, that they are actually accurately relayed to us now, then you don't see an emphasis on the individual. You see an when they're talking about things, and again, there will be people who disagree with me, and that's fine, but when they're talking, what is the kingdom of heaven? The kingdom of heaven, even within the Christian tradition, is not about all of us going to heaven and, you know, with our possessions. Here's where individuality leads you. Hey, I'm Mitt Romney. I'm worth $250 million. And when I go to heaven, I'll still be Mitt Romney, and I'll still be worth $250 million. What? No, you won't. That's where the individual analysis leads you, this idea that you will still be in heaven who or in the afterlife, whatever you want to call it, who you were in this life. That is so counterintuitive to everything that every major spiritual and religious tradition actually says about what the afterlife might be about, that you would have to, if you really took what they said seriously, you would say, no, that doesn't make any sense. I like to tell friends, usually to annoy them, that Jesus was a communist. And they go, what? Especially American friends. They go, well, have you actually read the Bible? The bits that Jesus, you know, I mean, I'm not talking about the book Leviticus. I'm talking the stuff Jesus actually said.
Wait, you got a problem with Leviticus? No, I'm just not messing with
you. I'm not a big fan of the Old Testament. Although, you know, it has its poetic value. But
it has its moments, I agree, yeah.
Too much begatting. It's like watching a porn film. there's a lot of begatting going on. But, you know, the idea, when you listen to him, it's the kind of thing that, and in Canada, there's a very long tradition, but also in the United States, it's buried now, you folks don't talk about it, of Christian socialism. Our primary socialist, even our left-wing NDP, it's now called the New Democratic Party up here in Canada, they don't like to talk about it. They're embarrassed by it. But the socialist movement in Canada was primarily founded, not solely, but primarily founded by Christian ministers. Most of the great early leaders of what was then known as the CCF were either ministers or involved in church, or they definitely came from a Christian tradition. And they looked at, and the Catholics have it too. These were Protestants, but the Catholics have it too. Liberation theology, which you saw in action in the Central America in particular in, say, the 1980s. Much more what you would call a socialistic or communistic way, a communal, let's call it communal, way of looking at humanity, that we're all interconnected, we're all linked together. That was the message of love, that universal love that Jesus brought to us. Whether or not you believe he was the Son of God, that was his message. And that's been lost. And I do, you know, there are elements of Marxist theology, or not Marxist theology, well, yeah, I guess theology, but Marxist philosophy that seep into the book. I mean, I quote from Guy Debord and Ralph Vinajem and these French sort of situationalist Marxist philosophers from the 1960s. I don't want to get into that at great length here, but...
Thank you.
There you go. But it relates to the human condition. People should be reading this stuff. I encourage the society, the spectacle, and the revolution of everyday life. But this idea that we are all interconnected, this is not a new age idea. This is an old age idea that we've just forgotten. And the Marxist deconstruction of this individualism that you talk about, that has become so much the center focus of American life and to a slightly lesser degree, but I would say life in Western society completely, stems back to the Protestant work ethic. So, well, okay, I used to teach when I was a graduate assistant, grad student in history, teaching assistant. I used to teach classes on, among other things, the Protestant work ethic. Well, where does it come from? Well, in the old days, before Calvinist theology, before free will, the idea of, because in Christianity now everybody talks about free will. Oh, we're all, you know, we make our own choices. Didn't always used to be that way. The original Protestants had this idea, where they would say, look, we have an elect, and only some of us are getting into heaven. And God's already figured it out. It was called predestination. So he already knows who you are, who's getting into heaven. When I used to, I'd do a class, and there'd be, say, 30 students in front of me. I'd say, look, here's the easy way to explain it. There's 30 of you, right? All right. You guys move your desk a little to the left, okay? Keep moving, keep moving. You two stay where you are, keep, okay? And so there's 28 of you over here, and there's two of you over here. Right. The two of you over here are going to heaven. The 28 over you over here are damned, and there's nothing you can do about it. Because I'm God, and I've already decided that. Like, what? I say, that's the way it used to be. But here's what that would lead to. You guys, now put your desk back. Now, everybody get up, move around, take a different desk, sit down. Fine. Don't worry, Jimmy. She's not going to steal your notebook. It's fine. And then I'd say, well, okay, wait a second now. How do you know amongst the 30 of you which ones I'm going to choose to go to heaven? I've already chosen. You know I've chosen, but you don't know who I've chosen. And they go, well, I don't know. I'm sure you've chosen me. I say, well, here's how they figured out that you would know. And this is where the Protestant work ethic, by and large, came from. Whoever had basically the most goodies, whoever was the most successful, had the most money, had the biggest house, had the nicest, whatever. Well, clearly God has favored you, right? That is the sign. Monetary wealth, material wealth, success. That is the sign of God favoring you. So that means you're one of the elect. And they go, okay, yeah, I guess. And I say, well, don't guess, because that's where it came from. And so then what people... And it's very clever. You know, if you want to talk about conspiracies and the powers that be, maybe somebody did cook this up. If you want people to work harder, this is what you do. You convince them, work harder, earn, be part of the system, and then accumulate all sorts of stuff, and that will be a sign of God's favor. You actually, even within free will Christianity today, it is still the way people seem to talk in the U.S. megachurches and all that. Even though they've allegedly long since left Calvinism and predestination behind, they still use that language. It still infuses our very society, where the more we earn, the more we, quote, quote, succeed, that is a sign of God's favor. And that is where it comes from. And that is counterintuitive to everything that you will find in the Gospels in terms of what Jesus was actually teaching. It wasn't about acquiring things. It wasn't about that kind of stuff. It was about spiritual salvation. There was supposedly a very real divorcing of the our world, you know, render under Caesar what is Caesar, and then render under God what is God. But we, in that time period when all of this, when they created this Protestant work ethic, they mixed it up. And so that's what's left. That's what we've been left with. And that is to me, at least, when I look at it, to no small part, where this obsession with the individual comes from. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with, I like being an individual, but I also believe that as individuals, we should also be aware that there might be something bigger than us. We might be part of something bigger than us, and we might be returning someday to something that's bigger than us. And so I don't have that obsession with individuality that maybe a lot of other people do.
I suppose, yeah. I mean, but you used the Mitt Romney example, and then you rolled it into this Protestant thing. But I guess my concern about the individuality has way less to do, because, listen, I don't have a pot to piss in or a window to throw it out, so I'm not worried about bringing my pot with me to fucking heaven.
Charming.
Yeah, thank you. Well, it's late.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
It's been a long conversation. I forgot people were actually still listening to us.
Yeah, no, that's true.
So it's more just sort of like, part of me sees your point of view in a way, because I want to say, you know, if you're all part of this homogeneous collective consciousness, then where is the source of new ideas? Where is, you know, if John Lennon and George Harrison are both part of the collective consciousness now, we're not getting the interplay of ideas, in a sense. But I suppose what you're trying to say is that you've evolved to the point where you don't need the interplay of, you don't need further learning?
No. The collective consciousness, or whatever you want to call it, is something happening after death, happening after many reincarnations or many trips through this world far down in the future. As long as we're here... Yeah, we're individuals. I think at times, you know, I'm trying to think of the best example. What's the best example? I was going to say a litter of kittens, but that's not what I'm trying to think of. You know, you take a cat out, then you put it back. No, that doesn't make any sense. I don't know.
Well, let me jump in and just say that
12 eggs maybe, and then you put them and you scramble them together and they're back to being one egg.
Is that what you're trying to say? Because that doesn't sound very appealing to me, because it's like there's...
It's not meant to be appealing.
Well, then I don't like it.
It's bad. It's the way that I think it is. It actually should be very appealing. I know the example that I didn't write in the book, but some of the artwork I use actually, sex. There we go. At the end of the day, if you want to make something appealing, bring it down to sex, because that'll work for everyone. So, here's how I would explain it, I guess. Let's assume that you can distill all of humanity to two people. Let's assume one of them is Tim Binal. And let's assume one of them is Jessica Alba. I don't know. I'm just going to pick somebody.
All right, I'll take it.
You would probably consider her hot. Fine. So that's it. That's humanity. Now, Tim Binal has two choices. Tim Binal can remain an individual by himself, or Tim Binal can choose to join with the rest of humanity.
That's now, Jessica Alba?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because that's a good thing. The rest of humanity is a good thing.
All right.
And you can experience so much more when you join with Jessica, the rest of humanity, Alba, or Paulina Peritsikova, or whoever. Who's Tom Brady married to? Giselle Bundchen?
I like Kate Upton myself. That would be my woman du jour right now.
Mine would be Melanie Griffith from the Something Wild film days, but that's very 1980s, so okay. Nobody would get that. But this idea... I don't understand why people I do understand it, but I don't understand it at the same time. It's just like people tell you it's bad to join, that you would be losing your individuality. I don't see it that way. I see it as enhancing your being, let's call it that. So you're adding, you by rejoining, let's call it the collective, if you were to rejoin the collective, you would be bringing your own experiences, which could have happened over many different lifetimes, and enhancing the collective. Whereas by joining the collective, you now have access to everybody else's experiences, too. So it's like going into a library.
Yeah.
I've written one book. Nick, at his most prolific, has written, 15 maybe, or 20?
It's over 20 now. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe he's written, let's say he's written 25.
Okay.
Nick could walk into the New York City Library with his 25 books, stick them on a shelf, and it would be an infinitesimal corner of all the books that would be in that library. So if you're Nick, what are you going to do? Just take your 25 books and say, well, that's it. I only care about my 25 books. No, you want to read as many, because you can learn things from all these other books, but you have to go to the library, or you have to, you know, whatever, take the online, you have to make an effort. So call it a library, or call it having sex with Jessica Alba, or whatever, but it's joining. There is nothing wrong with joining. There's nothing wrong with being part of something bigger than just yourself. And to me, that does not mean you are losing your individuality, which is not what I was trying to say, but it means you are enhancing your individuality, your being. And I think, again, like the whole science versus spirituality thing, the two are not mutually incompatible. But people don't like, certain people, the powers that be, shall we call it, don't like the idea of people thinking about the greater good, the common weal, things beyond just themselves, for a whole host of reasons, not the least of which is they might actually start questioning, hey, what the hell are you doing to the greater good, the common weal, the human condition? These things don't make sense. This obsession with wealth, this obsession with material goods, this obsession with all of these sort of peripheral things, we need to think of, and no, we don't want that, because we really are selfish, greedy people. So they like it when you think as individuals, to the exclusion of thinking that you can only be an individual. You can't be part of something bigger. It boggles my mind, Tim, when I hear people rail against government. And they say, government is evil. Well, first of all, government's like science. It's not a Cthulhu-like monster hiding over our heads. It's a collection of people and interests and stuff. They go, government is evil. And it crushes the rights of the individual and blah, 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 blah. And I just sit back and I go, do you understand what government is? It's us. We're government. People, like, it's not this mythical entity. It's people coming together.
Right.
And when people come together, they can do bad things and they can do good things. But it's nothing to be afraid of. It's not the enemy, because if you say government is the enemy, then we are the enemy because we are the government. And if you're not part of it, if you've divorced yourself from that, well, that's on you. because, you know, if you look and say, well, it's doing things that I don't want it to do. Well, really, yeah, that's because you're not participating. You just stand back and go, blah. So when I talk about this collective consciousness, I've just compared the ultimate in human achievement beyond death to the American government. But there you go.
Right, right. And I think, I think we can maybe find some common ground here on our points of view, because you use the example of Nick at the New York Public Library. And I guess what concerns me about the collective consciousness concept, but by your example, maybe you're leaving a loophole that will make me feel better, is that you're saying Nick, in this instance, as an example, still retains, I guess I'm not even concerned about individuality as much as personality. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I don't want to die and join up with this collective consciousness and lose perspective, if you will.
Yeah, I can't make that any better for you, Tim, because what is your personality? Your personality is, okay, who are you? How old are you now, Tim?
33,
fine. So you're 33, I'm 46. Who are you now? You're the 33-year-old Tim Banal. Is that the same Tim Banal, personality-wise, as the 5-year-old Tim Banal, the 10, 15, 20-year-old, as the 80-year-old
Tim
Banal
yeah.
will hopefully be? It's not. It is you at a moment of time. At 45, I'm not quite 46, if I was to travel back in time, and I talk about this in a roundabout way in the book, if I was to go back to that 20-year-old me who existed 25 years ago, I'm not sure that me would recognize this me. I'm not even sure. I mean, physically, obviously, I'm the same. I've aged, but this is the same body. It's just older. But what's inside it? I'm not that person anymore. I am the accumulation of a series of events and experiences that has changed me and will continue to change me as long as I live. But I'm not that person. I was at my old school when I was in elementary school. I just went for a walk the other day. And so for the first time in a couple of years, I went to my old stomping grounds when I was 7 and 8, used to play in the woods and everything. And I was walking through them and I thought, this is really cool and it's great. But I thought about who I was back then, and I am so far from who that person was.
All right. Well, maybe a better word instead of personality would be sentience.
Well, yeah, I don't think we would ever lose our sentience, although...
Then I feel better. Then I'll join up.
I think when you say sentience, you're still trying to... Like, who is Tim Banal? If you live to be... what is it? Say you live to be 100. Let's just... Because I think the math is easy. How many days would that be? 100 by 365. Can you do the math? That's 36,500 days, right? Or is that... Yeah.
Plus leap years, but go on.
Sure. Let's just say you live to be 36,000 days long. Well, you know how many Tim Banals there are? There's 36,000 of them. And even within those 36,000 days, you know, you can do the math on the minutes and seconds. Every second there's a different you, in a very infinitesimal sort of way. But if you want to look at it in a more macro way, let's just say every day there's a different you. And that you is different than the one who existed the day before, and it's different than the one that existed the day after. So every day, in a sense, Tim Banal is joining a collective consciousness. You know what that collective consciousness is? Tim Banal. So you're joining all the individuals that you've been in every day of your life is joining each day. You join the Tim Banal collective consciousness. And then the next day when you wake up, assuming you actually sleep, when you wake up, you're a new Tim Banal and you build again on the Tim Banal that existed before.
All right.
And you talk about personality. It gets into memory. How much of your childhood can you actually remember? Most of us can't remember very much. We remember certain incidents, things that, for good or ill, will stick out.
Right.
But by and large, most of it is lost to us. Well, that Paul Kimball or that Tim Banal is, for all intents and purposes, dead. And there's this one that's living now. A little bit of that old one has survived, but this is a new one. Well, to me, that's sort of what death and potentially moving to this collective consciousness would be like. A lot of what we think we are now, we would leave behind, but we would gain so much more that it would be just like waking up to a new day.
All right.
There's some very new agey stuff that I'm pretty sure most people who know me would never have expected to hear from me. But
well, I'm glad I asked. I'm glad I said we needed more time because
they knew the old
line of conversation took like a half hour.
Yeah, like I said, I ramble, man, but that's what it all is to me. It's like a beat novel where it really is, you know, you just kind of ramble, you do these thought experiments, these stream of consciousness things, and who knows where it's going to take you. But just the act of doing it, I sort of write in the book, the journey is the destination. I really do believe that. So many people are focused on getting somewhere. I'm just focused on getting on the road, and I have no idea where I'm going to wind up. I don't have a destination in mind, but I just kind of hope that the trip, and so far it has been, is interesting and enlightening, and in and of itself, the trip is worthwhile no matter where you wind up. So if at the end of the day there's nothing after we die, like literally the computer turns off and you're done, well, then I'll be no worse off than when I was born, because I can't remember anything before birth. I can barely remember anything before, you know, yesterday. So the older I get, the more true that is. So I'm not too worried about what happens after death, but I like to think that, you know, maybe I continue on. But if I don't, then it's been a good trip.
All right. So well, that's a good note to sort of segue here into the closing moments. Where can folks get the books? Do you have a preference for where they get the books? I know you've self-published this, so it's sometimes that can be the difference between quite a bit of money between where, you know, if somebody gets it on Amazon, next thing you know, you're only getting a different percentage than if they just bought it through your website. So what's the best way for people to get it?
Honestly, whatever's the easiest way for them to get it. So I'm not terribly concerned about. Yeah, okay.
No, don't do that.
The easiest way that they can legitimately pay for it under the legal commercial regime that we have created for ourselves, which I have to live in. So,
exactly.
You know, you can get it from Amazon. You can get it if you go to my company's website, redstarfilmtv.com. Go to the Red Star Books section. You can buy it from there, from our storefront. It'll be available. I've just signed an agreement with a major European ebook sort of on electronic distribution company, so all of my books will be available eventually, despite the fact I hate ebooks. But personally, I hate them, but I recognize a lot of people like them. So sometime in early 2013, both my book and the first volume of The Post-Human Blues will be available in ebook, and that's my plan. For any book that my company releases, it'll have an initial print run of anywhere from a day to a year, however long I want to just keep it in print, but then it'll go into electronic format on wider distribution. So
Nice.
It's my little, you know, it's my old school thing. I believe books should be held in your hand, and you should turn pages, you know, like paper. But I also understand that that's not the way the world is trending. So, you know.
You got to keep up with the times in most ways.
It is a business. You know, at the end of the day, I have to run a business and I have to report to people who are part of that business. So, yeah, sure.
And beyond that, what's next for you? I didn't want to really get too much into this, but you did talk about the MacBook. So you're working on sort of on a personal level, obviously the death of Mac really touched you very deeply. I mean, what is it like to sort of be, I mean, and you've taken on the role of sort of his intellectual caretaker, if you will. So, I mean, what's that, how does that make you feel? I mean, I don't want a Barbara Walters moment here, so, you know, just try and keep it together, but you know what I mean.
A couple of things. One, it makes his parents happy, and they're good people. I haven't met his dad, I should say, but when I was in Kansas City interviewing him, first time I met him in person, back in 2006 for Best Evidence, I did meet his mom. She's a lovely person. I correspond with her on a fairly regular basis. And I know that they, you know, without going into the nature of the private conversation, they were happy to let me do it, and I think they're pleased with the way the first volume at least turned out. For me, doing it, and it took me about a month to edit the first 2 years of his blog down into book format, really divorcing myself from having known him, it's a book that I would read. If I had never heard of this guy, I had never met him, and somebody had said, hey, here's a book about a guy who was writing it's kind of a diary, like Samuel Pepys.
I was going to use that example earlier, yeah.
Yeah, the great diarist from Britain in the 17th century. I think it was the 1600s, so the 17th century. It's not quite like that, but it is kind of like that. It's a document of the early 21st century. I think it is important from a historical point of view. So the historian in me, the person interested in that era and how people thought, I would be interested in it. But beyond all of that, it was actually like sitting down and having him sitting on my, next to me. Because when he was here, when we were running Doing Time, he stayed in my room and I slept out in the living room. So he was actually, my office is in my room, my bed that, don't take this the wrong way, that he slept in was right behind. He would get up and I would come in and I would be doing work, checking email, and he'd sit down next to me. And it was actually kind of like he was there and I was talking to him and listening to him. Because when you edit a book, I kind of say in the introduction to the book, there's a bit of me in there. I made changes to some of what he wrote. I corrected grammar and things because when you're blogging, even he in his blog said, look, I'm not going to be terribly concerned with grammar. Right. So to put it in print format for people who didn't know him, for people maybe 10 or 15 years down the road who are reading it, Mac would want it to be in a readable format. So in some cases, changes and footnotes and stuff. So a bit of me seeps into it. But as I say at the end of the book, that's probably fair. I think that's fair. You can't avoid that when you're an editor because he was very much a part of my life and my story, and I was part of his life and his story. So it just kind of makes sense to me that a little bit of me would seep into his book because a whole lot of him has seeped into mine. So yeah, it was great. It was like hanging out with my old friend, again, and, never got maudlin. I'd be sitting there and listening to R.E.M. and the Smiths as I was editing it. And yeah, it was a lot of fun. I enjoyed doing that more than I enjoyed writing my own book, frankly. Mm. And I enjoyed writing my book, don't get me wrong, but I really enjoyed the process of collaborating one last time. Well, yeah. Not one last time. I'll be doing it again and again, but collaborating again with the, excuse me. I'm not choked up. I'm actually just drawing because I've been talking. Collaborating with a guy who was one of my, three or four best friends.
Well, it's an admirable thing that you've done, and I wish you the best. And as I said, you can use, I'm far too lazy to do a transcript of my interview with Mac, but if you ever have time and you want to use it, go for it.
Yeah, well.
But again, I'm far too lazy.
It'll probably pop up in subsequent years because he'll be referencing, he hadn't done a lot of radio appearances, around 2000. He hadn't even released After the Martian Apocalypse. It came out in 2004, so he's writing about the process of writing it and then releasing it, and a bit of that shows up in the book. So, weirdly enough, I went through the index. The name that pops up the most often in the index is George W. Bush, because he was writing around the time of the Iraq War.
Oh, wow.
And the 2004 election, and it's... There are paranormal elements in the book. He talks about the paranormal in a number of places, but he talks far more about politics and society and just his day-to-day life. And to me, that's the far more interesting stuff, because you can read his paranormal, you can listen to your shows or Greg when he's on Radio Mysterios or when he was on Coast to Coast, and there he's really solely talking about the paranormal.
Right. With the blog, it's like a personal sort of
right. He
journal.
He was a great commenter on, or commentator rather, on just life and culture and all those sorts of things. And so the book's actually more about that than it is his paranormal thinking, even though there is some paranormal stuff in there too.
It's almost an evolution too, I think.
Yeah, well, it is. I had my friend Aaron Gullius, who never met Mac, but he's a historian, teaches in the United States, and who has you should have him on your show next year because they'll have a new book out called Extraterrestrials and the American Zeitgeist.
Oh, that sounds interesting.
It's being published by a major company. It's all about the history of sort of contacteeism and that kind of stuff. Very interesting guy, a very cool guy, but he wrote the introduction and the reason I asked him to do that was I didn't want a paranormalist like, me or Greg or Nick to write an introduction. I want a historian who could place it in its proper context that this is an important historical document that speaks to the time in which he was living. And here you have a very intelligent, thoughtful guy writing about that time. So it's a rare thing. So if people can only pick one of the two books up, I would recommend picking up The Post-Human Blues, Volume 1. Hopefully you buy both, but Max, it's a really cool book, and I was really happy to be able to do it and to continue doing the ones that are going to come after it.
Okay. Well, I'm glad we got a chance to talk about it. So.
Yeah.
So beyond, there's going to be three, I think you said three, maybe four subsequent volumes of that book. Nick's got a book coming out. A few other folks do as well. What else do you have planned at the Red Star Empire?
Well, yeah, that's the publishing wing. I actually, we're recording this interview on November 8th. I don't know when you'll have it available, but...
In December.
Time, there you go. By the time you're listening to this, I will actually be on set. I start shooting my next feature film here in Nova Scotia November 30th, in through the first couple weeks in December. So, yeah, a film called Damnation, which we have my British partners are distributing it and executive producing it. And it's the lead in. It's sort of the project that keeps me sort of creatively busy until I do a much larger feature film next year called Rubicon, which they're also partners on.
Nice.
So, yeah, you know, I've moved away. I don't really – the only documentary that I'm still looking at doing is Beyond Best Evidence. I will do that. I do intend to do that. Tim is a part of it when I finally get it off the ground, hopefully next year.
And for the folks who donated, we don't want them to think that they're assholes or anything. The money is safely in something, right?
Yes. And actually, one of the perks for donating to the film, if you reached a certain level, was, weirdly enough, you would get a copy of my as-yet-to-be-written book, The Other Side of Truth. As it turns out, I finished the book before I finished the film. So I will be sending out sometime before the end of the year, because I have a list of, I think it was 18 or 19 people who donated, maybe 20. I have a list of those people. They'll be getting
the dirty dozen.
Yeah, they'll be getting a copy of the book before they get a copy of the film. But the film will get made, and having done these feature films, or doing these feature films, will give me the resources I need to, I'll be diverting some of the resources from my salary to doing that film.
Right. Which takes a long time to make a movie and a longer time to make a good one, so.
It does, and it might, you know, I'll be buying into the Protestant work ethic and all that capitalistic stuff, because I definitely, you know, intend to get paid for doing these films, so.
Excellent.
So, yes. So, yeah, that's what get the publishing company, get the films coming up, and might even be getting back into the music industry sometime in the not-too-distant future. So.
Nice, nice. So finally, I found a place for my ska album to be made.
Oh, yes, your ska album. Well, okay, I'll have you contact my assistant about that. Actually, a Tim Benall ska album might be an interesting thing.
I've left those days behind me.
Oh, well, that's too bad.
I know. Anyway, on that ridiculous note, Paul, I think this is the longest conversation of season 7 here, but your wordiness, your enjoyable wordiness, combined with my yearning for more answers has really created quite the conversation. And I, honestly, I think this is not including the baseball episodes, which are superfluous bar talk conversations. I think we've done three shows together prior to this one, discussing the world of the paranormal and whatnot. And I honestly, I'd say that this is the best one we've ever done. So I've enjoyed it tremendously, and you know, it's been quite a conversation. One I've really enjoyed quite a bit, and I think, and I hope the listeners will enjoy it as well. So.
Well, the best conversation we ever had was the one we had at the casino here in Halifax at 4:30 in the morning. But unfortunately, we weren't taping that, and we were really inebriated. So it's probably best that we don't release that one publicly. But
even on the internet, that's unairable.
Yeah, no, that would be unairable, even especially when those girls wandered by. But this is number two with a bullet. This is the second best one with a bullet. So,
yeah. And I really did enjoy the book quite a bit. It's a combination of personal anecdotes, a personal journey. There's great stories in there that we didn't really get the chance to really digest here on the program, but there's a lot of great stories in there that combined with some really deep thought, which is what we focused on here tonight. So, and we really just scratched the surface of it in considering we got 3 hours of deep conversation going here, and really I think we could have just kept going and going for quite some time. So I think I hope that's the feeling people will get when they pick up The Other Side of Truth, that, you know, they have thoughts following reading it. So go out and get it, folks.
Hope so. Like I said, all I want to do is ask questions and people, you know, encourage them to find their own answers. So in my own way, given my thesis, I'm, you know, the advanced non-human intelligence, you know, fulfilling the same function. We should all be asking questions, and then everybody can find their own answers. So, yeah, thanks for having me on, Tim. It's always a pleasure.
Same here, buddy.
That does it for this edition of BOA Audio Season 7. Big, big thanks to Paul Kimball for coming back on the show and giving us so much time. Hugely appreciated. Loved the conversation. If you want to find out more from Paul Kimball, check out his website, www.redstarfilmtv.com. redstarfilm.com. Pretty simple, all one word, redstarfilmtv.com. Check it out. Moving right along now, it's time for BOA Audio listener feedback, and we've got two emails here in the mailbag, so let's dig on in. The first one comes from Carl. No hometown listed. Here's what he has to say. As a fairly new listener of BOA, a lot of the older shows are still fresh in my mind as I work my way through the archives. For example, I recently listened to Dr. Joy Pugh predict that Prince William would be crowned in 2012 and become the Antichrist. What about doing a doomsday retrospective now that we've survived the Mayan apocalypse and examine the various predictions of past guests to see what has and hasn't come to fruition? Maybe some of them would be willing to participate and comment. Carl. Thank you for writing in, Carl. Much appreciated. I actually haven't followed up on Dr. Joy Pugh. I'd be interested to see what she has to say in the wake of 2012. And however, though, I was thinking about your email here as I was reading it, and I can't recall too many folks who come on the show and make outright predictions. We don't really do psychics on the show. And even the conspiracy theorists and ufologists, most of the guests on the program really have shied away sort of from making any kind of definitive prediction, except for Dr. Joy Pugh. And I really can't say with 100% certainty that she said 2012 would be the big date, although it does sound familiar. Nonetheless, I would definitely be interested in doing a program like that with some of these guests if we had a whole bunch of folks who made predictions. So, I don't know. And I'm inherently lazy, so I cannot go back and look to see who else we could put on this Doomsday retrospective. It's definitely something that might be the seed for a different evolution of that concept down the line, but I definitely like the idea, and I certainly want to check out Dr. Joy Pugh's work right now. So literally, as I shut off the recorder here, taping the end cap, I'll be checking out Dr. Joy Pugh's website as this episode is uploading to see what she has had to say here in 2013. Our next email comes from Sharon Hill, editor of Doubtful News, and here's what she has to say. I heard on the Year in Review that you covered several stories that we also covered on Doubtful News, specifically the Baltic UFO and Mokele Mbembe expedition. I typically follow through on the stories to their ends if I can. You may be interested in these updates. And then there are a pair of links to updates on those stories. Followed by, I'm interested to know what you think of Doubtful News as a science-based source of weird news. Thanks, Sharon Hill, editor, Doubtful News. After I got this email, I checked out the links here that Sharon Hill provided and was sufficiently impressed that she has followed through on these mysteries here, and then as I dug further into Doubtful News, I was more and more impressed with what she had to say. I was like, this is an amazing website. And I actually was going to feature this email on the last edition of BOA Audio in the listener feedback portion of the program, but something crazy happened, folks. Something wild happened. I'm going to pull a Lost move on you here now, because I was so impressed with DoubtfulNews.com and Sharon Hill's work there at that website, and looked further into her stuff and found out that she is a major player in the world of skepticism and the skeptic community, and I was completely blown away. I was stunned. And then it kind of dawned on me that we need to have a skeptic on the show sometime, and Sharon Hill is perfect for that role. So here's where I pull the Lost on you, folks. Next time on BOA Audio, our guest is Sharon Hill, the editor of Doubtful News. And we're going to delve into the world of skepticism and the ongoing battle between skeptics and the paranormal and try and figure out if we can find a bridge between the two camps. Sharon actually told me in the conversation, which we taped last night, that she writes to paranormal sites all the time and is constantly ignored by them. But as soon as I saw her email and checked out her website, I was like, we have got to get this lady on the show. This is tremendous. So just one instance of how listener feedback can actually turn into a whole new edition of the program. It's not just listeners who write in with guest suggestions. It's also researchers and writers who have something to say, and then I take a further look at their stuff, and I'm like, wow, we need to bring them on to Banal of America. And once again, it's happened here with Sharon Hill. I'll talk a little bit more about it at the end of the program. I kind of just want to do a little twist here in listener feedback, do something a little bit different, pull a fast one on you by reading an email and then revealing that that person will be on the show. Those are the two emails here this week for listener feedback, but before we wrap up this segment, of course, it's time for an update on the BOA Facebook page. We have gotten stuck, folks. We're stuck at 898, and I think it is the promise of the shout-out at the end of the show. So in order to break this logjam, I think someone's afraid to be number 899. They're going to wait. There's people waiting it out. Or I'm just crazy paranoid. Nonetheless, for the folks out there who don't want to be 899 because they want the shout-out, I'll do the shout-out for numbers 899 and 900. So let's break this log jam. Let's get over the 900 mark, folks, and like Banal of America on Facebook. I posted there last week or so an article, completely blew my mind. I want to mention it here at the end of the show, that Stephen Hawking has now signed on to this think tank to research the potential for a robot apocalypse, the out-of-control robots theory that Stan Friedman decried on the holiday special continues onward, and now Stephen Hawking has joined up in this think tank. This is a true story. This is a real story that was in the newspaper, or online, I guess you could say. I don't read the newspaper, but you know what I mean. And we link that up at the BOA Facebook page. So there's always some new and cool stuff there that you want to check out. So head on over to Banal of America on Facebook. And if you want to take part in future installments of BOA audio listener feedback, there are numerous ways to do so. You can write to boaaudio@hotmail.com or head on over to banalofamerica.com and click the contact button. If you want something a little more interactive, you can join up at the official BOA forum, the usofe.com, theusofe.com. We like to call it BOA's paranormal playground, where we discuss the world of esoterica and pop culture. Additionally, I am on Facebook and Twitter, so just punch in Banal, B-I-N-N-A-L-L, and that way you'll find me on their search engines. Feel free to befriend me, follow me, or poke me. It's all good, and I'd be happy to have you as part of my online circle of friends. Any of those methods will put your correspondence into my hands to be featured on future installments of BOA Audio Listener Feedback. Up next, please allow me to thank the outstanding and esteemed BOA staff, Leslie, Chiron, Regan Lee, Joe V, Tina Senna, Richard Thomas, Marla Pena, Bruce Pretty, Tony Morrill, and our webmaster, Jeremy Boston. And now comes the time in the program where I take my hat off and pass it around to all the folks out there and ask you to make a donation to the Banal of America franchise. A lot of great folks stepped up to the plate in the last few days, and I really do appreciate that quite a bit. And just to tug at your heartstrings some, if you are listening to me on Saturday, January 26th, it's my birthday. Yep, it is my birthday, and I've produced this three-hour-plus program for all of you to enjoy. Consider it my bizarro birthday present to you. And if you'd like to return the favor, there's two ways you can do so. You can head on over to Banal of America and click the PayPal button. That'll take you to PayPal. They'll walk you through the process. It's safe, secure, and simple. But if you don't trust the internet and you want to send a snail mail donation, you can do so by writing to Tim Banal, P.O. Box 232, Pinehurst, Mass. 01866. The complete address can be found at Banal of America under the PayPal button. And please allow me to remind you once again, if you send in a donation, please make it payable to Tim Benall and not Benall of America, and include a means of correspondence so I can reach out to you and thank you for your donation. As always, it bears repeating, no donation is too small, and all donations go towards Benall of America and BOA Audio to help keep the entire franchise up and running, freely available, and commercial-free for all of our great readers and listeners the world over. I've already pulled a lost move on you and previewed the next edition of the program. Once again, our guest will be Sharon Hill, editor of Doubtful News. You can find that at doubtfulnews.com. Really a fantastic website. If I went there and it was all skeptibunkers ripping on people in the paranormal, I would have been very disappointed and this all would not have happened. But I was so impressed with Sharon's ultimate desire to really get to the bottom of all this, regardless of what it all means, that I knew that she'd be perfect for Benall of America. And there's a whole funny story that will unfold on the program when you hear it. As I said, we taped the conversation last night, and in the interim between Sharon sending me that email and us taping the program, she had some interesting comments about Benall of America, which we'll unpack on the program. I think folks will find that amusing. And as I said, we'll try and find some areas where we overlap, points where there could be cooperation and really the potential to build a bridge between the skeptic and paranormal community. This is not your average skeptic show, folks. This is a Benall of America skeptic show, and one I think you will really enjoy. Now, I was thinking of this as I was shifting the schedule around, because Sharon was not the originally planned guest for next week, but all this feels so timely that I wanted to put this together and out there for folks as soon as possible. We still have a tremendous edition of the program on tap for you following the Sharon Hill program. And I think it's perfect in a lot of ways to follow that episode, because our guest will be, I'll reveal it now here for the hardcore BOA audio listeners who've tuned in and maybe sitting here saying, what's going on? Kimball was kind of skeptical about a lot of stuff. Sharon Hill is an out and out skeptic. Benall, you're not turning toward the dark side. No, 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 my friends, because after the Sharon Hill edition of the program, our guest will be a pioneer in the world of paranormal research, the crypto hunter himself, John Rhodes. And John Rhodes does not do very many interviews, but made an exception for Benall of America. And if you're not familiar with him, you'll hear more about him at the end of the program next week. But he is the guy who popularized reptilians. He's the man who put reptilians on the map, and then so many other people in the world of esoterica picked up on reptilians and ran with it, and some of them made a lot of money on reptilians. John Rhodes is the guy who really lit the fuse, which blew up into the reptilian phenomenon. So we're going to talk all about reptilians and how they fit into the paranormal milieu. It is really one for the books and is, I think, a classic edition of the program. So believe me, my friends, we have not turned our back on our paranormal roots. We just keep adding to the bouillabaisse of esoterica here on BOA Audio. Stay tuned, my friends. And on that note, we close the book on this edition of the program. Big, big thanks once again to Paul Kimball for coming on the show. Thank you to Carl and Sharon for writing in on BOA Audio Listener Feedback. And enormous thanks to all you folks out there, the hardcore BOA Audio listeners, the folks who have been listening here from episode 1 to 721, or are listening for the first time ever. Thank you for your support of the program, and thank you for making BOA Audio a part of your esoteric audio playlist. Until next time, this is Tim Benall, thanking you for listening and signing off.